This is The Wave. I'm your host, Noah Griffith. It is currently 9:49 p.m. on Saturday night. Support for The Wave comes from great audiences like yourself. The idea for The Wave actually came from Jerry Seinfeld with his show, Comedians Getting Coffee in Cars. I was watching it over Friday night, and I really loved it. So I thought to myself, how can I do this and have my own spin on it? Well, I didn't get quite coffee, but I got some Burger King. And I'm currently driving back to Louisville. It's a little rainy. Jamming out to a little audio montage, Come With Me. But today our topic is Bernie Sanders. Before we get into Bernie Sanders, we need to talk about why we're talking about Bernie Sanders. In this last project we had to do a paper on subculture and what defines subculture. I did mine over the Bernie Sanders Democrat. I think it's a very interesting subject when you think about the partisan politics behind Bernie Sanders, especially considering his position against Clinton and the norms of the Democrat Party. While I was writing this paper and doing this video, this not video, but this audio clip, I was realizing that there's more than just, oh, he's a Democrat. It's a culture. There's groups dedicated to it. And I don't want to say it just came overnight. It came somewhere. But where? Before we could get to Bernie Sanders, I think it's very fair to start off with the history of this idea of populism. Because this was the year of the populists, that being 2016. We had two populists run that were very prominent. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. But before we get to what the main point of culture in the Bernie Sanders wing, we have to get to the point where populism was first identified in the Democrat Party. Populism is very hard to define where it started, but for modern sakes, we're going to ignore the Eugene V. Debs, the Bolshevik Revolution, and whatnot. We're going to start in 2000. Now, a lot of you probably scratch your head. 2000 is almost 20 years ago. And you're right. But something came out of there. We had just got a new president. We finally ousted Bill Clinton. And now have George Bush. And George Bush to the Democrat Party is toxic. Like, nobody in the Democrat Party wants to be associated with Bush. If he was incompetent, not ready for the post. But after years of soul searching, after Bill Clinton left office, there's an identity crisis, especially with disenfranchised voters in the northeastern parts who weren't loving Bill Clinton's very southern Dixiecrat style. They felt they were betrayed by the Democrat Party. That while it was great that they won, they wanted a candidate that could better suit the modern party. And we saw this division because running up to 2004 primaries, we had John Edwards, who was this very Southern Democrat. He was different. He was very close to Bill Clinton in a lot of ways. He was an attorney. He had an affair, but that's a different thing. He was a state senator, but he was a U.S. senator from North Carolina. He was an all-star in the Democrat Party, but from that, we also had John Kerry, who was the big Vietnam protester I think almost any American 40 and up could recognize. But something different happened. We didn't have a party insider. We had an outsider. Cue in the populism in 2004. Bringing Howard Dean. Howard Dean was a very different candidate. While admittedly a Dixiecrat, there was something he brought to the table that nobody did in 2000, and nobody was doing to that point in 2004. He used the internet. Now, we're all thinking back, what? Someone that couldn't use the internet? But the internet was drastically different back in 2004 now than it is now. Now, if you want a song, you can literally find it for 49 cents or free if you just use U-Magic to. But at this point, nobody really capitalized on how powerful the internet can be. So when Howard Dean finally used it, it was kind of like the initial fire. You know, we always have that joke of cavemen putting the stick to the stone and making fire. But he had these robocalls, he had the internet, and slowly but surely he was not necessarily running the board, but he was getting up in the polls and was actually taking down John Edwards and even putting putting John Kerry at his heels. We had this guy who was using words like we were going to do this, we're going to fix this. And it was a very refreshing change. America had just invaded Iraq. We went through 9/11. We were a very scared nation. And while President Bush did the best he could across the board, especially in foreign policy, Democrats were scared. We're like, we don't know if we can actually handle this. We don't have any proof we have weapons of mass destruction here. So when Howard Dean came onto the stage, it was a breath of fresh air. Like, we not only have a guy that's a Southern Dixiecrat, but at the same time, he knows how to connect with voters who feel disenfranchised. He knows what to do. He knows how to get the people in New England to vote with the Dixiecrat. A lot of Dixiecrats couldn't get to New England. But now that we have this guy, we can finally bridge the gap. But now we get to the Iowa caucus. The Iowa caucus came in 2004, and Howard Dean did so well. He finished second, which for a Democrat who was at the beginning of the race in pretty much last place was a miracle, you know. Now, that being said, a second place finish doesn't usually mean you won the nomination, but to come from zero to come to almost the top probably meant a lot to the Dean campaign. But unfortunately, one little gaffe ruined it. I don't know what it was. After he figured out that he got second place, he let out this little scream of like joy. And you know, at the time, I'm like, that's fine. You know, I'd be excited too. I'd be screaming, jumping for joy. But the media just kind of crushed it. It doesn't make sense. We've seen presidential gaffes even worse, like the one with Rick Perry in 2012, when he couldn't name the third department that he was going to cut. But for some odd reason, this just turned off everybody. And it effectively killed off populism for a bit. But like I was saying earlier with the fire, it started the spark. We had this populist candidate who actually kind of worked. While he was a Southern Dixiecrat, he had some New England policies as well. And this is where the populist Democrat starts coming into the picture. Now, we don't see a lot of people take to that populist movement from about 2004 to 2006, but we do in 2007. And we have a very odd primary in 2008 between President Barack Obama, at the time it was Senator Obama, and Senator Hillary Clinton from New York. Before we move on to the 2008 primary, I feel it's important to realize where populism was going from 2000 to 2008. So I feel like populism kind of stayed the same, only swinging a little bit left after 2008. Populism initially was this idea of bringing all the Democrats together, that it was a team effort, we're going to do this. But slowly, it moved left. And no one could really understand why, But it just did. With Howard Dean, we had the Southern Dixiecrat, but we're going to be coming up in 2008. Obama was a center left, but much further left than Howard Dean was willing to go. But since Obama takes office, this populist movement takes us and manifests in the left, even further left than Obama. It's really interesting. Because what started off as centrist, we're going to get this all together, kind of shifted towards a, we're going to get free healthcare, we're going to get this. While it has some of its original roots, it's drastically changed. And Obama has done a key role in changing that. Now going back to 2008, I feel like we could properly go on. See, Barack Obama is a very interesting candidate because while we have this Rust Belt senator, he's kind of left, you know? He sways from the party. And at the time, there was three big candidates. Well, two other big candidates that were running for the Democrat nomination. Hillary Clinton and John Edwards. John Edwards, as we stated earlier, didn't win the primary. So here was a Southern Democrat who really wasn't capitalizing on the internet, just trying to make it through. And Hillary Clinton was in a similar situation, but had more clout, not only being a former First Lady, but the current senator from New York. Now, something that I remember as a kid, this is a long time ago, it was 2007, 2008, Obama used the internet, like, it made Howard Dean look like a joke. For the first time, you saw groups on Facebook get together that we're going to get this, we're going to make it work. We saw these groups of people band together and say, we're going to get Barack Obama elected. And at the end of the day, that's what won. This populist movement, we're going to get this done. But Barack Obama eloquently put little elements of the left in there that nobody even realized at the time. He was the first, he wasn't the first Democrat to even think about free healthcare. This has been proposed since 1934. Both Barack Obama, there was a charisma about him that's undeniable. Whenever he walks in the room, he's going to get a reaction. Even if he's hated or loved, people listen to Barack Obama, just like they do Bernie Sanders. But with this new wave of populism, with connecting people, getting people together, they feel like they have a movement. That's the thing. Barack Obama talked about a movement and change, and that's what his populism was defined by. He was going to change the world, and he did. He changed politics drastically. And he went on to win the Democrat nomination, and then later, the presidential nomination. After the election of Barack Obama, there was a big sense of relief in the Democrat Party. Especially the populist movement, they're like, wow, we finally got a populist in office. But after that, there wasn't really much to write about, even to 2012. I mean, this is where the populism of the party started to diverge off from the regular wing. The populists really moved away, especially with the big banking crisis, you know, when we had to bail the big banks out. But that's when the split started. The populists were pretty much united with the centrists, in a way, in getting the Democrat on the ballot and winning. But in these years, it kind of split off. Now, to Barack Obama's credit, he managed to coalesce the group pretty much back together, taking a little hits in North Carolina and Indiana, but so pretty much holding on to what he had in 2008. But this is where I feel populism really started to move left, and very differently than what we saw earlier. We had the Republican waves in 2010 and 2014. And the big message of these midterm elections were, we're tired of the same old Democrat. And Barack Obama became kind of a boogeyman. He couldn't really coalesce all these, this populist faction and the centrist candidates. And for a while, the Democrats had no leader. At least the populace didn't. Until May 25th, 2015, Bernie Sanders entered the stage. I had mentioned earlier, when talking about how populism has evolved from the 2000s to 2016 to 2020 forward, that we went from a very, we're just going to get this done, nonchalant, not very specific, to we're going to get free healthcare. When Bernie Sanders stepped on the stage, he was a drastically different Democrat than what Barack Obama was. But in a lot of ways similar. See, Bernie Sanders knew how to use the internet. And quickly, within 2 months, he was actually getting the most traction of any candidate on either Republican, Democrat, Green, Libertarian, or any other party. It was really miraculous. And it was just this old-timer from Vermont saying, hey, I want to get free health care. I think we can do this. I want to see free tuition for college. We should get this done. And Bernie Sanders had a demeanor about him, this nice old-timer who knew what it was like to live in the golden age of America. And when I say the golden age of America, it's very subjective to what you define the golden age of America as. I feel like the golden age in America was probably 1950 to about 1963. We finally were done with the Pacific Theater. We had a booming economy. We had lots of great things going for us. We, in 1960, we elected this new charismatic leader who was going to change the world stage. And when, with Bernie Sanders, I think a lot of people felt that return to, I wouldn't say normalcy, but a return to what makes America great. This, we're going to get this done. We're going to help out our neighbor. We're going to make sure we're going to pull through this. We may have some bad times, but for every time there's a bad time, there's always a great time on the horizon. And Bernie Sanders' campaign was really based off that. He really made it an effort to say, I know things are bad right now, but we're going to work through this. We've worked through worse. We worked through the banking crisis. The banks haven't been nice to us, but we helped them out. We need to help out that person at the end of the street who's not making enough, who can't pay for health insurance. And after 8 years of Barack Obama, people are starting to listen. Earlier, I was mentioning in passing that Barack Obama didn't hold on to the same coalition from 2008-2012. It was close, but it wasn't quite the same. Now, we could say that this with historical perspective now that the 2016 campaign is over, but a lot of blue-collar Democrats kind of felt betrayed by the Obama Democrat. They were wondering why all their mills were shutting down, why all steel production was at an all-time low, and they didn't know where to run to. They kind of felt betrayed by the Democrats. And it was reflective in 2010 and 2014. Obama became that boogeyman. It was a brilliant tactic by the Republicans. And I could say this as an independent. But with Bernie Sanders, he realized that this was going to be a problem. And he's like, look, these trade deals have been hurting everybody. Especially these people in the Rust Belt, like Ohio, who don't have that steel job anymore. Or in Pennsylvania, who can't make that money anymore. And he knew how to resonate with those voters like nobody else did. He talked to them. He listened. That was the big thing. I think with modern politics, it's all about having this big campaign slogan or whatever. But to me, campaigning is a lot about talking. I think it's partially why Hillary Clinton lost, but that's for a different podcast altogether. Bernie Sanders knew how to talk to people like Obama did, or like Justin Trudeau does. Justin Trudeau isn't really a populist, but he knows how to talk to people. And modern Democrats, well, the post-Obama Democrat really doesn't know how to resonate with that Ohio voter. They know how to, put it bluntly, talk to the Starbucks Democrat who's getting a Frappuccino and talking about how bad their podcast is. In an ironic way, bad. Not actually bad. But Bernie Sanders represented this, bringing the party back together before it's too late. Fortunately, too little too late. Now, this really doesn't apply to anybody that's listening right now. Probably applies closer to 10 years from now. But you're probably thinking, wait, if this guy's just like Barack Obama, why didn't he win? He should have won this. He has all these characteristics, very charismatic, very well-spoken, very resonant to people, but there was one obstacle that stood in his way, Hillary Clinton. Now, we all know that Hillary Clinton also ran in 2008, but because Obama was this big-as-life candidate, he won. But we now learned that Hillary Clinton essentially rigged the primary against Bernie Sanders, because if you were there in 2015, you remember Bernie Sanders was not even, was a joke. They're like, this Democratic socialist from Vermont wants to be president. Let me get a hit of that. I'll take a hit to that, Bernie. But it was a quick rise, and it was miraculous to watch as well, because when we got to the Iowa caucus, I was like, oh, it could go either way. And you know what? It was pretty damn close. It was almost a 50-50 split. It was 49.8 to 49.6. Like, holy hell. The guy that was supposedly a joke somehow managed to bring us to the top. He managed to coalesce all these groups of voters that we never thought would be possible. He brought these old people. Then he also brought these younger voters. They called themselves Berniecrats. They organized. They got the phone banking going on. And he was leading the charge. He was talking, saying, hey, we could do this. We're going to get free healthcare. You got to work with me, but we're going to get this done. As, you know, he was willing to reach across the aisle and still be a socialist. But that's the power of populism. Even if you are at the far end of the extreme of a party, the populism wing makes you seem like you could cross the aisle. Because if you look, Bernie Sanders is actually kind of close to Trump on trade policy and foreign policy, mind you. But some things were never meant to be. After losing the Democrat nomination, the Berniecrats were kind of disenfranchised. They felt betrayed by Hillary Clinton. They didn't really feel welcome. They were like, well, I don't like Trump, but I really don't like Clinton. Because if they liked Clinton, they would have voted for the primary. You know, I think that's a little common knowledge. But they're at this crossroads of, where do we go? We've essentially been alienated because we voted for Bernie. But now, there was nowhere to go. And well, this probably happened to John Kerry now, I think about it. Because these voters had nowhere to go, I honestly believe that because of that, they moved elsewhere. In 2004, they moved to the Green Party. They might have done that as well in this election. But now, it was kind of lost. Disenfranchised. Kind of weird how history repeats. We had this guy that didn't have a chance, but almost won the Iowa caucus, ultimately to lose, and his party lost. But I think that's how populism works, in a sense. As soon as we had this grow, and then we had this big win, and then it starts dying off, but the cycle repeats. And that's how this subculture works, too. Of populism, yeah, well, not also how it works, but it's how it works. It just gravitates from different candidates. We had Howard Dean at the beginning, but we went to Howard Dean to Barack Obama, to Bernie Sanders. So I fully believe that we'll have a very populist Democrat in 2020, and it might stand a good chance against President Trump. Yeah, that's just my thoughts. To end this piece, I really feel as if, in terms of populism, it goes not from Bernie Sanders, but it's an underlying message of working together. I don't feel it just solely belongs to Bernie Sanders. It belongs to a collective. That sounds stupid and very cliche, but to say it exclusively belongs to one person is partially asinine. Because it belongs to those people. It means something to them. Whenever you meet a Bernie crowd, they're wanting to fight. But this is a very interesting group, this democratic populism. Because I think it evolves. I was talking earlier about how it starts off with the little flame, but it then grows into something big. But I think the right word is it's this subculture that breeds the new culture. It sounds kind of crazy, but it kind of repeats itself too. So maybe it's not completely new, but there's a lot of new elements to it. But at the bare bone, it's the same. It just evolves differently. Now, my question I want to leave you with is, will the Democrats run another populist candidate? Will we see the return of the Dixiecrat? What is the future of the Democrat Party? Now, I don't know any of these answers. If I did, I wouldn't be going to college and being a music educator. I'd be working on the campaign. But I think it's time to call it quits. This is The Wave, your host Noah Griffith, signing off.